Okay. All right, so let's talk about the rabbis. Oh, and I'll pass this. This is the text, which we'll spend most of our time talking about. All right, let's talk about the rabbis. What is the... let me summarize one last thing about Pardes or the biblical period. I think that one way to think about what she is saying is that the myth of the nation survived the destruction of the physical state. Right, and even though the biblical story itself is super complicated in all the ways that she's talking about, the point is when first the Babylonians in 586 before the Common Era, I'll put these dates up for you to just have 586 BCE. That's the Babylonians. Temple one, and then 70. Of the Common Era, that's the Romans. Temple 2. Even though the physical basis of Jewish or Israelite nationalism is destroyed, the symbol, i.e. the temple, is destroyed, the state is effectively destroyed, the point is the nation survives. It survives textually in some fashion, even though the process of actually creating the Hebrew Bible as we have it is a long one. But I think the sense of the power of the origins survives. And the reality of the Jews as an ethnos, as a people, that survives too. In this period, of course, you have this much subtler transition from something that we would call Israelite religion, the cult, the temple, the priesthood, blah, 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 to this thing that we call Judaism and Jewishness. Torah as opposed to temple, right? The beginnings of some notion of kind of study, culture, right? Scholasticism, right? This famous story about Ezra saying in Babylonia, Ezra saying, we'll take the Bible out every week and read a piece of it on market days as a kind of a civic exercise, right? So interesting things are happening culturally, ritualistically. You begin to get this new class of people, these scholar people whose legitimacy comes, in many ways, totally made up. Right? It comes from themselves, basically asserting, oh, Judaism is about interpreting revelation. It's about studying a book. A scripture needs to be read, needs to be studied. And we are the ones who are going to help you do that. So a bunch of interesting cultural, ritualistic, religious moves that culminated in this thing that we call Judaism and Rabbinic Judaism. That's a really long process. The rabbis don't win out over other groups, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the early Jewish Christians, right? A lot of different interesting things are happening philosophically, politically, communally. But it's somewhere in the period from, say, 500 before the Common Era to 500 of the Common Era, or maybe 600, say, you know, Muhammad emerges in the early part of the 7th century of the Common Era, somewhere in that millennium, which I realize is a kind of an incredible thing to think about, you know, a process that takes 1,000 years, but through that period, ultimately the rabbis end up kind of winning. They're the ones who, in effect, become the expositors of what is the thing that we call Rabbinic Judaism, a kind of a text-based Judaism, halakha, you know, what Jewish excellence is. It's about mastery of the text, pulling out of it theology as well as practice. That's rabbinic Judaism. And the stuff that I gave you to look at, the David Beal piece about rabbinic sense, you know, how the rabbis thought about history and politics, and then this little piece that we'll spend most of the time on, which is the Talmudic text from the Tractate Ketubot, give you a sense, it seems to me, at least inferentially, of the way that they're thinking about stuff like history and politics and about the nation, you know, what constitutes the group. So what do you think? What did you get? Let's talk about Beal first a little bit. And then we'll spend the last time on the rest of the time on the text, the Talmudic text itself, the political theory of the diaspora. What's he arguing there? And by the way, Karen had mentioned that a lot of these PDFs are sideways. I am not opposed to sideways reading. Sometimes reading these texts sideways actually injects clarity. So don't knock sideways all the time. But David's a friend of mine, so I shouldn't say that about him. Butch, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, he's trying to tell us that during the diaspora, during the Middle Ages, there was a Jewish power, there was Jewish self-governance, there was Jewish semi-democratic governance during that period, and that there was a theory of political governance during that period.
Okay.
As opposed to what many people were saying was that it was entirely run by the rabbis who were maintaining their own power.
Okay. Peter?
It's clear in the article that, you know, God is becoming less and less important, wasn't controlling things, and then the world changed. Clearly states that.
Yeah, which it sounds a little bit like what Halbertal was talking about. Okay. What else? I think that's all true. Absolutely. Right? Is God in history, according to the rabbis? Post-destruction? Right, post-destruction of the temple, what happens to God's role in history? Right, this is a kind of a key move they make. Right, what happens to God's presence in history?
He's not there.
He's exiled too. Right, in other words, there is a tremendous kind of vacuum that they're positing, and that vacuum is filled by human beings.
And not the Levites.
Yeah. That's right. So yes, this is a kind of a reworking of covenantal Judaism that says, in a kind of a relative way, the power of one radical in the equation, the divine radical, that power wanes. And with the waning of the power of the value of that radical, to use a kind of a mathematical way of thinking about it, the value of the other radical in the equation, namely Israel, that value goes way up. They're the ones doing all this stuff. It's about the self-governance thing. Human activism. So, of course, he's playing, you know, in some ways, David is really arguing against, excuse me, a very Zionistic reading of Jewish history. We'll talk much more about this next week, which said basically, oh yeah, once you, the rabbis basically condemned us to powerlessness. The rabbis said that in place of earthly power, you should just embrace the divine. Embrace your powerlessness, and in some ways go back to what Halbertal was talking about, God is king. And that's what life was like in diaspora. David, in some ways, is saying exactly the opposite. which is the rabbis were saying, no, don't embrace powerlessness, embrace power. The difference is, it's power in effect of the human community, the rabbinic community, the rabbis as text readers. The power that is going out is God's power in many ways. Of course, they never want to say that explicitly because that would be too overtly post-theological. So there they don't go. But this is David, in some ways, giving a kind of a counter-Zionist reading. Remember, we'll talk a lot more about this when you get to the Zionist. The Zionist narrative is very much the diaspora was terrible precisely because Jews had no politics. Jews had no taste for power. They had no aptitude for it. They didn't value it. David is basically saying, baloney. It's a totally one-dimensional reading of the diaspora, totally one-dimensional reading of the rabbis. You're turning them into guys with feet of clay, when in fact, they were innovative, brave, very present, very, in some ways, humanistic, productive policy people. And they built a system. Did it last? Did it work?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It kept Jewish communities vibrant and creative and productive, both in the world as well as doing the Jewy stuff. Right? It kept them that way for over 1,000 years. So, if you know, the Zionists, in effect, were saying in a very crude way, you know, 2.0 was terrible. If you say 1.0 was the Bible, 2.0 was the rabbi, Zionists said, oh, 2.0 was terrible. Because it was such a winnowing, a kind of shrunken identity because of its lack of politics. David is saying, you know, au contraire, super political. What do you think of the argument? What do you think of his argument? I mean, you're not scholars of Jewish history, so I'm not asking you so much on that level, but what do you think about this general claim that sort of, in effect, repoliticizes the rabbis? And I'm not, politicization here is a compliment. It's not like, oh yeah, they're just politicians. Like, we have an incredibly negative view typically. We think of that as a modifier, as a pejorative. Right? In fact, it's the ultimate opposite of that, because if you don't have a politics, it means you can't really live in the world in some way. So, he certainly doesn't mean it as a pejorative. He thinks it's wonderful these rabbis had a politics. So, what do you think of the argument?
Well, I think there's some validity in it, because you can see where the rabbis are helping, in a sense, to keep a state within a state.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And without them, I don't think you would have...
Hard to know what would have... Yeah, in terms of the whole vacuum thing, right? Assimilation might have been much more of a danger in these different, you know, civilizations under Islam or Christianity, what have you. As it is, it was a challenge. Other comments on his piece? Okay, well, let's take a... Did I send the Talmudic text around? Does everybody have that? Okay, I only made for you one page because this is a crucial page. Okay, so, and when I give you this kind of stuff, reading rabbinic primary documents is very difficult, and you may feel like, why am I reading this? Don't worry about it. We'll get to it in class. So this chapter, this is a tractate that's dealing with ketubot. Ketubot or what?
Contracts.
Marital contracts. Okay. So the question that this Mishnah, you're not seeing them. I mean, if you printed out or looked at the original set of the whole thing that begins at the beginning of the chapter. The Mishnah was really dealing with a bunch of questions, all of which somehow dilated on the issue of what happens in terms of paying off a ketubah in a case where there's marital discord around one party that wants to be in the land of Israel and the other party doesn't. It might be a prospective disagreement, like we're living in Boston, one person gets the aliyah bug, the other one doesn't want to go, and which case, what should happen in terms of the disposition of the marital contract. Could be the opposite scenario where you're living in Israel, one person gets, you know, postdoc at Stanford. Can you go or not? So they're all sort of playing with these different scenarios around the kind of meta question, which is there a kind of an independent standing to being in the land of Israel that has a kind of a legal ramification in terms of the paying out of a bridal contract, the ketubah? Okay, that all the niceties of that need not detain us here, but that's really what is going on in this chapter. But then, of course, in classical Jewish Talmudic fashion, they sort of wander off into other kinds of ways of exploring the larger conceptual issue, which is, okay, what do we really feel about the land of Israel, and what kind of a real hold does it exercise upon us? So if you look at the piece that I just gave out to you on page 712, on the, you know, the left side of that page, you see here the third paragraph, our rabbis taught. Everybody see where I am? Okay, would somebody like to read that paragraph? This is in English, in case you haven't noticed. So you shouldn't have any, you know all 26 letters of the alphabet, you should be able to do this. Ray Leah, thank you, dear.
Our rabbis taught, one should always live in the land of Israel, even in a town most of whose inhabitants are idolaters. But let no one live outside the land, even in a town most of whose inhabitants are Israelites. For whoever lives in the land of Israel may be considered to have a god, but whoever lives outside the land may be regarded as one who has no god. For it is said in Scripture to give you the land of Canaan to be your god. Has he then, who does not live in the land, no god? But this is what the text intended to tell you, that whoever lives outside the land may be regarded as one who worships idols. Similarly, it was said in Scripture in the story of David, For they have driven me out this day, that I should not cleave to the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. Now whoever said to David, serve other gods, but the text intended to tell you that whoever lives outside the land may be regarded as one who worships idols.
Okay. Thank you, Ray Leah. All right, so what is the argument that this little piece of text is making? What's the argument it's making? Got to live in the land of Israel. How come?
Otherwise, you don't have your God.
Otherwise, you lose God. You lose access to God, whatever that means. Okay, do you buy that as a theological statement? Only people living in the land of Israel have access to God?
No.
And what would you say in terms of Jewish history writ large? Would you say this is the operative theology of Judaism throughout the ages? That, well, if you're living in Warsaw, you have no God? Is that sound like the operative theology? Absolutely not. Okay, so assuming that this is pretty obviously not the case, there's something kind of deeply counterintuitive about this claim. So the question is, assuming that they're as smart as we are, so then how come they're claiming this? Or, yeah, Ed?
It might not have been counterintuitive prior to 70 AD.
Okay, although, but this is post-70. This is a rabbinic text.
Right.
But
it still has recent...
Okay, so maybe there's like an older layer or resonance here that they're somehow pushing along. Okay, but you, look, you, you, yeah, Wendy?
Could the land of Israel be a metaphor?
It could, although in this case it's not. But it's a fair inference. But you're trying, you're doing something good though, which is you're trying to say, look, all I've got is a text. You have to try to figure out what is the backstory to the text. What's the context of the text? So what do you think, what, try to figure out, try to work backwards in effect from the text to the causes, the authors that generated this text. Who would write a text like this?
Was there a belief that in the diaspora it was spread out without actually having a state that we were a weaker people?
Okay, for sure. A strategic view that might say dispersion is inherently bad. Yeah, Pam? Yeah, it could be very much tied up with a messianic view of history, absolutely. Although this is much more sort of doubling down in a very practical way, saying, no, you absolutely have got to stay here. It, you're absolutely right. It might be you would abort the messianic process by leaving, and that would be awful. So for sure, that's a plausible reading. But they're very, very, oh yeah, they're trying to scare people, don't leave. Yeah, Jan and then Wendy, yeah?
Well, it's about Jewish marriage contracts.
Yeah.
So living in Israel is where that counts. If you're outside of it, the law of marriage vis-a-vis a ketubah may not at this time.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. There might be a kind of a legal piece of that around that. Yeah, perhaps. Yeah. Wait, Ruth, is that Ed or Ruth Ann? Yeah, okay. Well, perhaps, although they do mention that this is such an kind of an overriding imperative that they're saying even in the context where most of the people who live in the land of Israel are not Jewish, you still have to stay. In other words, even if it's been totally overrun by Greco-Roman classical notions of paganism, blah, 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 you still have to stay. I mean, you could argue, as many of us argue today, in sometimes honestly, sometimes less so, oh, you know what, I think Jewish life is richer in New York than it is in Tel Aviv. I mean, that's a legitimate argument. It might be wrong, it might be right, but the point is people make that kind of argument all the time. So, absolutely, it is somehow tied to issues around assimilation, but it's not really clear whether or not this is actually a sound strategy around anti-assimilation, because they knew that in this period, the land was undergoing a process of de-Judaization in many ways. So that's another piece. Yeah, Wendy.
So could it be, and I don't remember, but there was the Babylonian Talmud and the Israel said that they're like competing with the people in Babylon, and so, they want to say we're the real
terrific
people.
Fabulous. So who would be the author of this piece? Very good. A Palestinian rabbi. What you are seeing here in the text, we'll see the second part in a second. What you are seeing here is a kind of like, remember when we were kids, those National Geographic specials, you know, like watching a flower bloom or a, you know, butterfly from the chrysalis kind of deal. So what you're seeing here is a kind of a time-lapse photo of Jewish history in the rabbinic period. The first layer of the story is the Palestinian layer that Ray Leah just read. By the way, the textual hint of this, we didn't look at the original, the textual hint of this is in the very first tiny little mini phrase, our rabbis taught. Our rabbis taught in Hebrew is Tanu Rabbanan. Our rabbis taught. The fact that it's in Hebrew with that kind of nomenclature is a clue that it's a text from the Tanaitic period, which is from the year 70 to 200, meaning right after the temple is destroyed for the next couple of generations, and it's in Palestine. These are Palestinian rabbis writing in Hebrew, saying what? Stay. And of course, they never talk, one of my teachers, Gerson Cohen, used to say, the rabbis don't talk about anything unless they need to. So what is it that they need to be dealing with? What's the problem?
People are leaving.
People are leaving. How come? Huh? Right. Temple was destroyed. Things were hard. David mentioned in the political theory piece, Bar Kokhba, which was a total disaster in the middle of the second century. So the land is really kind of being despoiled for them. And the Palestinian rabbis are freaking out. The Jews are literally running away. Where are they going? I mean, Wendy sort of gave the answer already. Where are they going? Babylonia. They're going to New York. They got a letter from their cousin with $300 for the boat to come. I have a bakery. You'll work here. I'll get you a visa. Your kid will end up going for free to City College. Then they'll end up in Scarsdale. It'll be very nice for you here. Come to New York. That's Babylonia. Reconstitute your Jewish life in a space. And by the way, this is the national thing. What you're getting is a diaspora nationalism saying, I mean, we'll get that in the Babylonian thing, but the point is the Palestinians see this happening. History is sort of slipping away from them. History is slipping through their fingers. And their attitude is very, I mean, think about, you know, we're watching this fabulous theater called the 2016 election. It's that there's a theater piece to this. What is the one weapon that they have to keep people from leaving? God, the Jewishness of the land. Several of you mentioned this before. Louise, other people brought it up. The one thing they have, the one trump they can play, is to say, if you leave, you will lose the taste, the texture, the potency of the land. Yes, you'll have central air conditioning in Scarsdale. Very nice. And your kid will go off, you know, to Columbia College. Also very nice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, you'll lose the meaning. You'll lose the texture. You'll lose the potency. Is it a good argument? Yeah, I mean, maybe not as good as central air conditioning in Columbia College, but the point is, it's an argument. It's the only thing they've got. Because history is the vector of history is going in a different direction. That's diaspora, that's empire. Salo Varone, speaking of Columbia, the great historian taught at Columbia for a million years, said, you want to study Jewish history? Study the trade routes. The trade routes were taking them away from Palestine. The rabbis weren't idiots. They knew that. They got up in the morning, they read the New York Times too. They knew what was going on. This is the only argument they have. You'll lose the meaning. You'll lose God. If you care about God, so maybe you will find this compelling. Right? So that's the argument. Okay.
There must have been a counter-argument.
Well, here's the counter-argument. So who wants to read the second paragraph? You'll get this counter-argument right now. So this is the Palestinian layer. This is the Palestinian layer. The earlier stratum when they're trying to hang on to Jewish life in Palestine from somewhere from 70 to 200. Yeah, Bruce?
That's a true question.
Yeah, absolutely.
At what point is that area of the world started referred to as Palestine, which you've been calling it?
No, I wouldn't. That's an anachronistic.
Palestinian rabbis, whatever.
Yeah, no, that's an anachronism on my part. Absolutely.
What is it should be referred to, and what's that era?
Eretz Israel, they're still calling it that in some fashion. They call that in Hebrew here. They do. Palestine comes from the Roman, the Latin term that will sort of come in to in this period, a Rosa Lamita. But that's a little bit, so, but they're not referring to it here. They're speaking in, they're writing in Hebrew and they're calling it Eretz Israel. Okay, who wants to read Rabbi Zeira?
Yeah, I'll read it.
Yeah, Karen, thank you.
R is there
a... R is for rabbi.
Oh, that's true. Rabbi Zerah was evading Rab Judah because he desired to go up to the land of Israel where Rab Judah had expressed the following view. Whoever goes up from Babylon to the land of Israel transgresses a positive commandment, for it is said in the scripture, they shall be carried to Babylon, and they shall be until the day that I remember, saith the Lord. And Rabbi Zerah, the text refers to the vessels of the ministry. And Rab Judah, another text is also available. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelle and by the hinds of the field, that ye awaken not, stir up love until it please. Sorry, it's hard to read this.
That's okay.
And Rab Zerah, that implies that Israel shall not go up altogether as if surrounded by a wall. And Rab Judah, another I adjure you is written in the scripture. And Rab Zerah, the text is required for the exposition of Rabbi Jose, son of...
Yossi. Yossi, son of Rabbi Hanina.
Son of who said, what is the purpose of those three adjurations? One, that Israel should not go up altogether as if it is surrounded by a wall. The second, that where be the Holy One, blessed be He, adjured Israel that they shall not rebel against the nations of the world. And the third is whereby the Holy One, blessed be He, adjured that the adulterers, that they shall not oppress Israel too much.
Okay, stop there. All right. See, this is why Talmud is so easy to study. What's going on in this piece? This one's much harder than the first one. What's going on in this one? Can anybody parse this?
He's telling you all the bad things that are going to happen if you leave.
If you leave where? Babylonia. Good. So this is, first of all, again, if we were looking at this in the original, you would see this text is written in Aramaic, which is sort of the lingua franca, mix my metaphors, of Babylonian Jewish society. They write the post-Mishnaic, post-Tanitic stuff, post-200, stuff they write in Aramaic. So the language is different. Now, interesting, you've got a couple of different rabbis here. You've got Rabbi Zerah, and you've got Rav Yehuda. How come one is called Rebbe and the other one's called Rav? Anybody know about that?
The son
and
the father?
No. Good guess, though, but yeah.
Aren't they like at different times? They're writing in different...
Not so much. Rebbe...
Rebbe means a senior.
Okay, senior meaning what, like... Not quite, because in fact, Rav Judah is Rebbe Zerah's senior. It's more... It's Rebbe is somebody who has gotten their ordination in the land of Israel. Okay? Rav is a Babylonian rabbi. So what's interesting here, it's great that you brought up the generational piece. What's interesting here is Rav is the master of Rebbe Zerah. But Rebbe Zerah actually has a more prestigious ordination than a teacher. So what we have here is a case of probably a Babylonian-born guy, Zerah, who then went to the land of Israel, got ordained, then he went back to Babylonia. But then he decides to do what? He wants to go back. He loves the land of Israel. He's loyal to it. He wants to go back. He's afraid to sort of tell his teacher openly, I want to go back. So he says, oh, I'm going down to the corner pack. He's sort of got a pack of smoke, and then he's going to kind of run off, sort of in the middle of the night sort of thing. That's kind of almost like the feeling you get from this. He's afraid to tell him directly, look, we disagree. You want to stay here? I want to go back to the land of Israel. And he can't bring himself to do it, so he's trying to avoid it. But the point is, he can't really avoid it. So ultimately, they have a real argument about what he should do. So what does Rav Judah say to him? This is a crucial piece at the very beginning of that paragraph. He says you can't go. Rav Judah says to Rav Zera, I understand that you want to go, but you can't. How come? What's his reasoning? No, no, you've already skipped. What's the legal statement that Rav Judah makes? Whoever goes up from Babylon to the land of Israel transgresses a positive commandment. Make sure you understand that. What does that mean?
You're breaking a law.
You're breaking a law. There are two kinds of laws. There are negative ones, like thou shalt not steal, murder, etc. The negative ones are like the Hobbesian ones, right? In other words, if you society depends upon people not breaking the negative ones, because without those, you got no shot of having a civil society. The positive ones are in some ways much more idealistic, like you shall give charity, you know, tzedakah, you shall leave a corner of your field for the poor. These are wonderful things. Excuse me?
Love your father and your mother.
Exactly. Again, truly impossible things to do, like keeping Shabbos, loving your parents, you know, blah, blah, blah. So those are the ideal things. In other words, if you can sort of get some traction on the positive ones, you're not only going to sort of keep from killing each other, but you actually have the shot of really building a beautiful society. So, but are you aware of the fact that not making Aliyah, that remaining in Babylonia or Cape Town or Warsaw or wherever is a positive commandment? Are you aware of that? Does your Torah include, when does Wes stand up from the beam and say, oh yes, I want just to remind you, for those of you who are thinking of going on Nefesh B'Nefesh, if you do that, you are violating a positive commandment, because you are supposed to remain a member of my congregation and live on Ward Street and pay these outrageous dues, etc., 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 and that's a positive commandment. Are you aware of that? So where is he getting this from? Where is he getting it from? Yes, but then he quotes a bunch of non-five books of Moses sources, like the Song of Songs, prophetic texts. You're not supposed to rely upon non-legal texts for legal rulings. That's a kind of a rabbinic hermeneutic thing. So, okay, anybody remember their Marbury v. Madison? What's the basis of judicial review? What's the basis of judicial review? Who made it up? Was it in the Constitution? No. Right. Marshall. Right? He made it up. This Babylonian rabbi is making it up. He's saying, listen, there's a new community, a new sheriff in town, the Babylonians. And we are saying the basis of Jewish peoplehood now is going to be filtered through a kind of a Babylonian Torah. The ultimate text of which is what? Wendy said this a few minutes ago. What's the ultimate expression of Babylonian communal, spiritual, legal, intellectual greatness? The Talmud. And what they are saying is, this is the new center. This also, by the way, jives very nicely with what Professor Pardes said. Where is home in Jewish life? Is home always the land of Israel? Maybe not. The Babylonians will write all kinds of very, and we're going to have to stop in a minute, but the Babylonians are going to write all kinds of very funky midrashim that say, you know what? Your nursing mother, to go back to some of these beautiful metaphors of natality that Pardes wrote about, your nursing mother was Babylonian. Because the legend of the world was, what was the navel of the world? The Fertile Crescent. Right? And where was that? The Tigris and the Euphrates. So the Babylonians will say, we are the Garden of Eden. We are the mother. Home is here. Israel is the foreign thing. And so, therefore, when we say, well, it's a positive commandment to remain in Babylonia, it becomes much more intuitive according to that whole worldview. So this is a kind of a reconstituting of the nation that says, yeah, the nation is going to be centered around a new text, a new Torah, the Babylonian Talmud. The nation is going to be centered around a new set of political actors called the rabbis, the Babylonian rabbis. And we will figure out a way. This is what David was writing about in the political theory piece. We will do just fine here. We will not lose our sense of groupiness. We will remain Jewy Jews. In fact, we will become better Jewy Jews because now we have books that will help us know what do you do when the milk dud falls into Raelia's chicken soup 20 minutes before candlelight. We will teach you how to do that. We will teach you how to make chicken soup. We will teach you the laws. We will build these magnificent communities. And this, of course, will become, and by the way, this text will become the authoritative text of anti-Zionist forces in the land of Israel, in neighborhoods like Mea Shearim, B'nai Brak. They will cite this text as, listen, what are the Zionists guilty of? They're guilty of violating this law that the Talmud proclaimed over 1,000 years ago, which is you shouldn't go up to the land of Israel as a political rejection of diaspora. Because God wanted you to be in diaspora. If he hadn't wanted you to be in diaspora, he wouldn't have sent you there in the first place. So this is really the birth of that mentality. Questions or comments?
So who compiled
the two? The redactors of the Talmud, these editor people, probably around the year 500 of the Common Era. And what they do is they show you through the language moves sort of the seams of the text, the historical layers. Questions or comments about that? And by the way, the fact that they go last, Palestinian layer first, Babylonian layer second, so in effect, who is winning? The Babylonians, because they wrote the book. They get to decide who wins, and the answer is they win. The Palestinian layer is preserved for us, and speaking of Marbury v. Madison, the minority opinion is preserved for us, but it's overridden by the later opinion of, coincidentally, themselves. So they win. And this is Jewish national identity in the diaspora, which is this kind of meta-identity that lives around halakha, Talmud, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Yes, Raelia.
The Jerusalem Talmud.
Yeah.
Written about the same time?
Earlier, a little bit earlier. And, of course, part of the Babylonians winning is the Jerusalem Talmud becomes a much more scholastic, much less accessible, much less studied text. It's like, remember when we were young adults? What was the Betamax? What was the other one before VHS?
Beta.
Right? And a lot of people said, again, this is like the Bill Gates, Steve Jobs thing. A lot of people said, hey, the Betamax was a much better product, but VHS won. Right? So the point is, it's not a question of which text was better on the merits. The point is the Babylonians are the ones who had the power. And so they marketed their text much more aggressively than the Palestinians. But great question, Raelia. Thank you for raising it. All right, so I will see you next week.